Welcome to The Art of Medicine, the program that explores the arts, business, and clinical aspects of the practice of medicine. I'm Dr. Andrew Wilner, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Robert McLean. Welcome, Dr. McLean.
Well, thank you.
Now, Dr. McLean, you are the president of the American College of Physicians and also a practicing physician, internist, and rheumatologist. So you're a busy guy, and I wanted to talk to you today about what the college is doing and what physicians are doing. I think it's important to say that today is April 16th, 2020. So what's happening on April 16th, 2020 is we seem to be in the midst of this COVID pandemic that is affecting everyone. Everyone's learned how to use Zoom, right? And that's what we're doing now. So I wanted to talk to you, I guess, well, tell us first a little bit about your background, and then I have some burning questions about how physicians should deal with this current situation.
Right. Well, so I've had the good fortune this year to be the president of the American College of Physicians, which, as you know, is the specialty organization for internal medicine. I've been in practice now for 25 years in New Haven, Connecticut, initially a small four-man group, which then grew into a couple other different groups joining us for 10 or 15 years. And then we entered the electronic record stage and decided that it was the better part of valor for multiple reasons to become part of a larger network that the local hospital system was developing, which was Yale New Haven Health System. So we became part of what's called Northeast Medical Group, which now stretches across all of Southern Connecticut. And in that role, I actually, through a lot of experience I got through the ACP, understanding health policy and a lot of things about what's changing in the world, things like clinical integration and quality and safety, actually was asked to take on a role as a part-time medical director in those areas. So I had been doing a combination of primary care medicine and rheumatology for most of 20 years or so. And then as I took on a little bit of an administrative role, going now about 4 or 5 years, I realized that I couldn't be a good primary care doctor if I wasn't in the office all day. So I decided to transition away from doing primary care, which is much harder than doing a subspecialty, and do mainly rheumatology practice in my office 60 to 70% of the week. And the other 30% or so is administrative until this past year when, after many years of involvement in the ACP, for a lot of advocacy and policy stuff, I was a chapter governor for Connecticut for a few years, that was on the Board of Regents, and then became the president this year, which took a bit of time as well. So it's been a very busy year. It was extremely gratifying. Unfortunately, our national meeting, as many national meetings, which was supposed to be next week, has now gotten canceled. So there's going to be a couple of remote things, as all of us are learning how to do. But it's changed things a lot. And the ACP has been very active in this last 2 months, trying to figure out how to help physicians in many, many ways, trying to help address some of the public policy concerns, the regulations, the laws getting passed, all that stuff that everyone sees in the news every day, trying to decide, where do we comment on something? Should we comment? Should we not? All that kind of stuff. Very interesting.
All right. Now, before we delve into that, I just need to share that our paths have crossed. I'm a board-certified internist as well as a board-certified neurologist. I'm a fellow of the American College, and I stopped doing internal medicine many, many years ago because it was too hard. And I wanted to pick something easy, like being a specialist in neurology. So I also practiced as a neurohospitalist in New London, Connecticut for a year at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital. I started their neurohospitalist program, I guess, about 10 years ago. And they are now part of your system. And I worked there. I was part of all of those growing pains with McKesson, EMR, and going into. It's very, very interesting. So, what is the American
think you had a Tennessee accent, so I didn't know how long you were down there.
Yes, I am in Memphis now, associate professor of neurology at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center, which I enjoy immensely. But my past experience really helped prepare me, I think, for this position. So I'm a New Englander at heart and from a long time in the past. So tell me, what is the American College doing? Are there any official policies or statements about COVID-19 and how the physicians on the front line are dealing with this?
So yes, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, we have made a number of different positions and statements for different reasons. Since it's now Thursday the 16th, I'll tell you that just yesterday, we put out a statement that we felt needed to be public, which was that we thought that it was a bad idea for the president to defund the U.S. involvement with the WHO. So that was kind of the most recent from just yesterday. Earlier this week, there was a letter that was sent to, and it was made public with a press statement to leaders in the House talking about a number of the different items that we think need to be in the next stimulus funding bill around the COVID crisis. We sent a similar letter to CMS just yesterday outlining a number of things that CMS we think still needs to do more, things like lessening up prior authorization requirements, looking at paying for phone visits on par with telemedicine or video visits. They indicated a week ago that they would in fact pay for phone visits, but those codes actually are paid significantly less. And we know that a lot of physicians are relying on phone visits for contact with a lot of their patients. And some of that is not just because it's easier, it's because the patients just don't have access to broadband or Wi-Fi or whatever, or don't have smartphones that you need to do the video visits. So those were a couple things from a practice pay standpoint. We have made a statement back 10 days, 2 weeks ago, a letter to the FDA talking about concerns about drug shortage issues and, you know, what kind of strategy is needed for drug mitigation, kind of with a reference to hydroxychloroquine, but not directly calling that out, at least in that setting. But we'll be planning to say something more about the concerns over hydroxychloroquine being used outside of clinical trial settings, you know, as we, I think, see in the news. Those are some of the big ones. I think early on, about 2 weeks ago, we kind of put out a statement agreeing with social distancing as a, you know, public health good at this point. We put out a statement indicating that given all the concerns about social distancing and the contagiousness, that we really felt that it needed to be stated so that patients understood and that physicians were encouraged that they really needed to empty out their offices of patients and kind of try to figure out how to help deliver care remotely through either audio only or video visits. But that, you know, there are lots of changes that we agreed with from the standpoint of CDC recommendations that we felt that we needed to publicly endorse.
And if we wanted to see these statements, I assume we could go to the American College of Physicians website.
Yes. And ACPOnline.org has a column on the right called ACP News. And every time that one of these statements or press releases is put out there with links to some of these letters, there's an ongoing list that is, it grows bigger by one or two items, I would say, almost every day. And in addition to that, I should say, so what else has the ACP done? Going back a month, I think we realized that there was really going to be a need for significant education on a lot of stuff around COVID management. So early on, we created on the website, and this is free to members and non-members alike, we're calling it the Physician's Guide to COVID. And that is updated literally every day or two by people in our incredible education department. And it has almost like chapters of things and what's been updated on every angle of anything around COVID management that's in there. So I would really encourage people, if they have not, to go there. I was told last week that when you looked at the sites that were kind of like searched for COVID information, that behind the CDC, at least among physicians, I don't know how they measure this, behind the CDC website, the ACP's website on COVID was actually the second most searched.
Right. Well, the ACP has a huge number of physicians. How many physicians are members of ACP?
159,000 total members. About, I think, 12,000 to 15,000 are actually international. And a good number, I don't know, 10, 20 or more, are actually medical students. And then internal medicine residents as well. But it's the largest specialty group in the country. The only larger organization by total numbers is the AMA, which is up in the mid 200,000, I think.
Well, if it's okay with you, I want to talk about one of the topics that we're not hearing about in all of the from the CDC or from ACP, and that's medical ethics. My observation is that most physicians have been more than eager to treat COVID-19 patients, even at risk to themselves. I mean, there's story after story of physicians and nurses and other providers working with less than adequate protection and taking care of patients, but not going home. And I still go to work when I'm supposed to go to work, and I see patients. We're trying to minimize contact with telemedicine when possible, but if we need to see the patient in person, that's what we do. So, I talked to one person, they said, oh, it says that in the, in the Hippocratic Oath, doctors are supposed to put themselves before their patients. So I went and looked it up. It doesn't say anything like that at all. So where does this come from?
So, it's very interesting. As the ACP president, I get to write a monthly column in our newsletter. And actually, I did one 2 or 3 months ago about oaths and charters and what the statements and documents are that we tend to think drive how we behave. And it's very interesting to go back and actually look in English at what the Hippocratic Oath says and doesn't say. It doesn't say a lot of that stuff that people think. It actually focuses on, as you probably know, almost like adoration of your teachers, respecting your teachers. There's a lot about handing down knowledge and, kind of the next generation, and some kind of ancient things, not giving poisons, which is where the first do no harm comes from. But the Hippocratic Oath kind of said things and was really quite dated, understandably. I think many people realized that people, when they were graduating from medical school, typically said the Hippocratic Oath as they entered the profession. I'm not certain exactly where when that was starting, but I think that there was a recognition that the old Hippocratic Oath was quite a bit dated. So there was a physician, I think it was around 1964, who was a dean somewhere. Correct me if I'm wrong. I can't remember where he was, who kind of wrote a modern Hippocratic Oath, which ended up becoming the Hippocratic Oath that I think most people are more familiar with, and kind of stated at medical graduations. Since that time, the Hippocratic Oath was kind of used as kind of the basis, if you go back, for the code of ethics that the AMA created when it was first formed back in, I think, 1847. That was kind of one of these old charters or oaths, which actually tried to put in language and bring the Hippocratic Oath up to a little bit more of a modern day stance, as the profession was trying to define itself back in the 1800s as a profession as distinct from other guilds. The AMA Code of Ethics still holds a lot today. It's gotten updated in significant ways. There was a significant update to that back in, I think it was 1948, the Declaration of Human Rights that came out of, I think it was at Helsinki after World War II, when there was a recognition that physicians did bad things in Nazi Germany. And so there are very specific statements about physicians not doing certain things in that. So that's a much more modern kind of oath. And then there was the Charter on Professionalism, which was created by the American College of Physicians Foundation, the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, and the European Federation of Internal Medicine, kind of the Internists of Europe, which together, those three groups put together a document in around 2001 that talked about professionalism and professional behavior. So I'm kind of giving you a long discussion, but the point of my article was that all of those charters and oaths are kind of pieces of paper and things. And they help guide us and give us guardrails on what we should or shouldn't do in certain situations. But by and large, as physicians, there is this internal drive to help people, to do the right thing. And that's what doctors do. And it's treating the sick. It's going into epidemics. It's knowing that you have the knowledge and the ability to help where others cannot. And so people don't, I think in the article I said, people don't kind of read the Hippocratic Oath, should I do this or that? They act, and it becomes part of their inner being. And so I think what you're seeing now in a lot of the reaction to the epidemic is that this is what we do. You know, doctors think this way. They have a responsibility to society. Yes, that we talk about this social contract of sorts, but people don't think about that. And it's amazing to hear the stories and see the people who have not been in the hospital for 10, 15, 20 years who are saying, you know, sign me up, send me in. You know, now there's a provision there, which is with the contagiousness, as we all know, about self-preservation and safety. So actually one of the statements, which I forgot to mention, which the ACP made a week or so ago, was saying doctors and all healthcare workers, they have a right to PPE. Personal protective equipment, and healthcare systems have a responsibility to provide it. And part of the reason for our statement a week or so ago, and we all know this, but part of the reason was that there were stories in the news about doctors who were being called out for not following policy, and doctors who had brought in their own PPE because they didn't feel that the PPE provided at their hospital or wherever was adequate were being, you know, threatened or whatever. And they also were told, you can't talk about this in public. So we put out a very strong statement a week or so ago saying, A, all healthcare workers, especially physicians, have a right to bring in their own PPE if what they're being given is not adequate. And in addition, they have a right and, in fact, an ethical responsibility, which we have in our kind of ethics manual, to speak out on concerns that might relate to working conditions at a hospital and public health. So that kind of relates to what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that removing the gag rule, I think, is very important. So on a previous program, I spoke with a locum tenens recruiter. I've done a lot of locum tenens work in my career. And I said, well, you know, you have physicians volunteering coming out of the woodwork who want to go into battle. I said, are there any physicians who are kind of saying, you know, I'm signed up to go next week to New York City for this assignment, but, you know, I'm having second thoughts. And indeed, there are some. Interestingly, he pointed out that it was not the older physicians at highest risk who were the ones that predominated in sort of withdrawing, that it was across the board. But the high risk group was not the group that was saying, no, I don't want to go. So it looked like there might be some generational component to the sort of that inner ethical drive. But what would you say if a physician says, you know what, I don't want to go to the hospital. You know, I'm 65 years old. I've got COPD. You know, I had my stent put in a couple of weeks ago. They say I can go back to work, but I don't want to go. What do you think about that?
No, very challenging. I think that we're in our health system where I am now, you know, the decision was made that people who were clearly identified to be at higher risk should not be seeing patients. So for example, we've said, you know, we emptied out the offices and the directive was given, do not see people, you know, for non-urgent visits. And we also said, listen, if somebody is over the age of 65, that's kind of one of the designated higher risk categories. They should just be doing, you know, virtual visits and should not see patients, period, right now, whether hospital, inpatient, or outpatient. So we kind of made that one a little easier. And if they have some sort of immunosuppressive or chronic health condition, we don't want them, the people who are at higher risk, we don't want anyone to get sick, obviously. I think the people who are at higher risk, there's a greater threat of losing our physician workforce or being limited if they get sick. So there's kind of the level of, we need to have as many doctors and other healthcare workers as possible doing the necessary work. And a lot of that is, in fact, remote access for patients. All of that work is not in person. As long as we have enough people who are under 65, who are comfortable doing it, who are adequately skilled and trained to do that, it hasn't become an issue. Now, it hasn't become an issue yet. We've had a number of physicians I know across our group in different parts of Southern Connecticut who have volunteered, some of them 10 plus years out of the hospital, who've gone in. We put a system in place. They kind of shadow one of the hospitalists for a day or two to get their feet wet a little bit and get comfortable before they're kind of one of the hospitalists again. That's a huge deal, and my hat is off to them. I've been out of the hospital for 25 years, and I've got enough administrative stuff that I'm not being asked yet, but when the question comes, absolutely. You know, I think it's, we have to do what we can. I'm not in New York City. The stories are really astounding of the people, the volunteers, you know, the numbers. They put a call out for retired doctors and recently retired doctors to come back, and it was like, I don't know, 10 or 20,000. It was astounding, doctors volunteering to come back. So I said to somebody yesterday, you know, one of the reasons I think that physicians have had such a high rate of burnout in recent years, and people have talked about this a lot, is because there's a bit of administrative overload, a feeling of lack of appreciation for what physicians do and how they do it. And this crisis is, I think, giving people who are questioning their purpose and meaning, it's giving them phenomenal meaning, you know. And I think that it is going to take a lot of the grumblings that caused burnout among physicians and kind of push them aside a little bit. We still have huge, you know, administrative burden problems and whatnot in our dysfunctional system that still needs to be fixed. But I think that people at their core are getting back to what it really means to be a physician, why they're doing it, how what really gives them meaning is helping people and getting to a better place.
Okay, two questions. First, I'm still on the shy side of 65, but that is going to change imminently. Has the American College come out with a statement that says it is reasonable for physicians who are, you know, 65 and older to withdraw from face-to-face clinical care? Because I think that would be an important tool for physicians like myself or other physicians to bring to their employer and say, hey, you know, they're telling us that it's not safe. We shouldn't be doing that.
We had not come out with a statement saying that. I think if we started to hear news that was, you know, happening, and people, despite the pretty strong recommendation that those are higher risk people and that those doctors were being forced to go into situations that where they are potentially at higher risk, then I think that would be something that we would, you know, have to talk about. But no, we don't have a policy at this point saying that.
All right, so let me jump ahead. Let's assume that this COVID pandemic is actually contained and, you know, a month from now we have a vaccine and it's done. So what about the changes in medicine? We've had in fantastic changes where telemedicine now has been, which has been percolating for a long time. And I mean, I did telemedicine for stroke years ago, but now everyone is doing it. And the regulations that have prevented its growth, for example, you have to have a state license in every single state, you know, where your patient is. And there are telemedicine physicians now have 25 state licenses, which is a huge administrative burden. And then credentialing, state licenses. You know, I can go work in Mississippi tomorrow without a Mississippi license now because of COVID. Do you think any of that is going to carry over? And people say, you know, we didn't really need those regulations.
I think there's a very good possibility that a lot of those regulations will be looked at again. I think especially the stuff around telehealth. I mean, anyone in practice for a number of years clearly recognizes that you can deliver a lot of good health care by talking to someone on the phone. We do it, you know, when we're on call the weekends before we had some of these modalities. And so does all routine follow-up visits where you're not, you know, measuring the blood pressure necessarily, but you're seeing how they're doing or tolerating a new medicine, whatever. We knew we could do this. And the problem was that we weren't getting paid for it. Whether phone calls were never being paid. There have been codes for phone calls for like 10 plus years at least. no payer or Medicare ever paid for them before this. That's a huge change. They're still not paying for them adequately in terms of the time spent, but there is an RVU value and all that stuff. And now we're putting pressure on the payers and Medicare to pay for it in parity with office visits, partially because the practices that have emptied out need it for sustainability. The telehealth visits were slowly rolling out in certain areas. There were limits, I believe, from CMS for rural areas and in different aspects. So now everyone, I mean, we did in 20 days what we were thinking about for 20 years. It really is remarkable. I think that that is going to take hold in a much greater way. So those are two, that paradigm of how do we deliver care. There's always still going to be, you know, the stuff you need to do in person. I think when you look at all the things that have been put on hold, you know, I think you kind of realize, God, how many things that we do are really elective? Like, how necessary are there? Are they? When we think about, you know, saving lives, you kind of cut down to what do you really need to do and what don't you? And there's a lot of elective stuff that's pretty elective in our healthcare system. It's just kind of part of the fat, you know, really. Granted, a lot of the things ultimately do need to get done. I mean, a lot of the preventive healthcare, those things need to get done. I'm not kind of minimizing those, but there's a lot of things that I think people will say, gosh, we did fine without, you know, procedure X for 3 months. Should we really be doing so many of those on, you know, so many people? So where the money's flowing and why, I think will get questioned a little bit. I think the connection of health insurance to employability is going to be a huge one. You know, we've been stuck in a system that got created after World War II, where health insurance became a benefit to employment. And now I just saw, I think on the news this morning, in the last 3 weeks, you've had 22 million people filing for unemployment. So those people are going to be uninsured. And sure, you could say, hey, you could buy COBRA, but you got to have income to buy COBRA. And, you know, hopefully you can get into the ACA, you know, exchange that costs money, or maybe you'll qualify for Medicaid. So I think the whole financing of where does health insurance come from? Where should it come from? What role does our government play in delivering health care? What role does our government play in having a public health infrastructure? There's some major paradigms that I think are going to be questioned and will be changing going forward after this.
Well, I'm glad I have an in now with the president of ACP because...
Only 10 more days.
Because I'm a big fan of these kind of improvements in our system. I want to touch on one other kind of delicate issue. You know, physicians are rushing to the front lines, risking their lives to help save patients. And then they're getting an email that says, oh, by the way, we're cutting your salary 10%, 20%. Mayo Clinic, I just saw the email, cutting everyone's salary across the board 10% until January. I worked at the Mayo Clinic a few years ago. It's a wonderful institution. They pay their doctors well. They treat everyone well. Obviously, there's less money. All these elective things, and they have a lot of foreign people that come with cash, not coming, you know, can't fly. So there's less money. I understand that. But how can you, you know, on the one hand, pat everybody on the back and say, yeah, go rush into battle. And by the way, we're going to pay you less at the same time. That just doesn't seem right.
I completely agree. I think that how these healthcare systems, in many cases, which employ doctors now, where they're spending money, where their salaries are going, how much administration they have, and how much they're getting paid has always been a concern, at least in some circles. At this point, there's always been so many regulations and things, and it's so hard to get the payers to pay because everyone's always denying and fighting bills. So there are these huge infrastructures that relate to the inefficiencies of our whole payment system. And, you know, if you look at people who kind of look at those big numbers, it's estimated that 15, 20% of our healthcare dollar, you know, goes toward administration or waste or excess or whatever. 20% is a lot of money. I think at this point, you got to realize it's got to go to the people who are doing the work. And I think there's going to be a greater recognition that healthcare workers are doing the work. how that's going to, you know, fall out is really challenging. I think that at the same time as, you know, if you look at the Mayo story, cutting physician incomes or everyone by, you know, 20%, clearly that kind of sounds draconian. When the economy is kind of going into free fall or might, I mean, 80% of an okay salary for most physicians is still something you can live on. You know, quite frankly, I'm not defending it, but I think when the economy is going south, everyone is probably going to feel it in some way, and that's unavoidable. But boy, it's going to be hard to see what goes on in the next, you know, 6 months for certain.
Dr. McLean, it has been a pleasure to speak with you today. I want to thank you for spending the time with us. I'll mention we are doing a YouTube Zoom interview. This is also available on podcast. You know, if you're driving in your car or exercising and can't sit down and watch it, this same program is also available on podcast players. So usually I end by saying, well, how can people get in touch with you? I think that's pretty straightforward, right? Just an ACP website, and I'll put that up. And you mentioned only 10 more days. What happens then?
Well, so our term runs from one annual meeting to the next. So as I mentioned, our annual meeting, which was supposed to have been in Los Angeles, we made the decision to cancel it probably now a good 6 weeks ago. We had to. All the big medical meetings have gotten canceled. So we're going to do a couple of remote things, and I will hand over my presidential title to the next president, who's a woman from Georgia by the name of Jacqueline Fincher. So she'll have the role to be the kind of spokesman for the ACP for a year hence. So I have a couple still responsibilities with the college for the next year or so, but I'll kind of fall off the cliff in certain ways.
Well, I have a feeling you'll still keep your hand in it to advance the agendas that we've discussed.
Absolutely. I've gotten involved with advocacy through the ACP going back to the late 1990s, locally in Connecticut, and then it just grew into a national level in terms of their health and public policy committee and a whole bunch of things. And I've probably earned the equivalent of an MPH twice over with all of the different policy papers that I kind of participated in. But it taught me in several situations where the importance of physician advocacy, which has really been kind of my passion, realizing that as much as I love seeing patients and interacting with patients on an individual level, when you get to a point where you have the opportunity to help educate regulators and lawmakers about the importance of different issues, and then can actually see some of the ideas that you have helped plant into their brains become part of different laws, you really feel like you've made a difference for, you know, many, many more people. And I think that especially now in the last few weeks, a lot of these statements and letters we've had with CMS especially has made some of these changes occur. I mean, I don't know if phone calls would have gotten paid at all if we hadn't been, you know, really barking up that tree for the last several weeks. And I think a lot of physicians don't realize that these things don't just happen. A lot of organized medicine, the ACP, the AMA, a lot of other organized groups are doing a lot of work behind the scenes. And they need physician members to be sustainable to do this work. But most of that work is kind of invisible to a lot of docs. And I think I would like to see them recognize it more, because it just doesn't just happen.
Well, you're making me feel better for the dues I've been paying for the last 30 years.
Good.
So that's great. And thanks again for joining us. It's been a terrific program.
Thank you.